Barb. We're rolling. Good morning. Call to order the Subcommittee on Redistricting. Thank the punctual members. I know we'll have two more joining us in a few minutes here. I think what I'll do is I was going to do introductions at the front end, but since we'll have more members in a few minutes, let's hold off on that. And I'm going to ask Mr. Bodern to go through kind of a 20,000-foot introductory overview to this process and encourage members that the PowerPoint is in your packets. And we've gone over some of these materials with Mr. Bodern already, and so I know he's prepared to take questions at any time. Just let me know when you want to be recognized. And again, we'll save a little time at the end here to do some committee introductions and just make it clear to folks who's doing what and how we're going to move forward on this as a committee working together. So, Mr. Bodern, thank you for your work already on behalf of this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. And before I begin, I should point out here, this is a historical overview, and the idea is to give you a good sense. By having a sense of where it's been, you'll have a good sense of where you are now in the process. And before I go a whole lot further, I must point out most of these materials, just about all of them, were prepared and presented by Matt Gehring, my counterpart in the House. I've had the opportunity to work with him and look at him, so he certainly made my job easier today. And it's really interesting. I think you'll find it helpful. So what I'll tell you today, very briefly, is kind of an overview, decade by decade, of how the redistricting process has unfolded in Minnesota, beginning in the early 1900s, and with a little more focus on the 1990s and the 2000s. The process has become increasingly complex over time. I think that's a reasonably fair statement. At the very end, the slides provide a timeline for how things will unfold. Let's go around. In the beginning, the state constitution did make some provision for how redistricting should occur. And Article 4, Section 3 of the state constitution has a couple of, I think the what I would highlight for you, since we're moving fairly quickly, is you'll see the, I think it's the second to last or third to last sentence that says that senators shall be chosen by single districts of convenient contiguous territory. So right off the bat, unlike some other states, at least historically speaking, no multi-member Senate districts, and districts must be convenient and contiguous. Because I'm moving quickly here, I won't labor on the details there. The early history is kind of fascinating. In 1913, you can see the size of the legislature was set at 67 senators and 130 representatives. What the fascinating part is that no redistricting occurred from 1913 through 1959. Hmm. The obvious backdrop there are two things. One, there was no federal court pressure for states to move toward the one-person, one-vote principle. And you can guess that those who drew the districts in 1913 liked the way they were drawn and didn't see the need to change them despite shifts in population. In 1933, however, there was a congressional redistricting plan because Minnesota lost its 10th congressional district. And I provided here a map. I won't spend a great deal of time on it. It's in the – I think it shows up reasonably well in the printout. But what's interesting about this is you can see, at least in terms of size, how uniform some of these districts are. And I think a good number of them were drawn along county lines. Same thing for the congressional districts here, although there is certainly some familiarity in the patterns you see here. Moving ahead, things began to change a little more rapidly beginning in the 1950s. In 1960, Minnesota's population was about 3.5 million. That was a 14% increase from 1950, but that was insufficient to prevent the loss of the 9th congressional district, and that's when Minnesota moved to 8 congressional districts, where it remains today. In 1958, the first significant litigation was filed that really affected how the redistricting process would take place, or at least placed pressure on the legislature to do something. You can see that at the top here, in 1950, if you compare it to the districts that were drawn in roughly 1910, there had been a 43.7 increase in the state's population. including, I think, the largest example in Anoka County, 184, almost 185% increase. So if you compare the size of some of these districts, you could see the smallest district, the 4th Ward in St. Paul, had 7,290 inhabitants. The largest in Hennepin County, 107,246. So there's a considerable disparity there. And the translation there is, if you're thinking about applying the one person, one vote principle, one voter in the smallest district was equivalent to 14.7 voters in the largest. So in the McGraw v. Donovan case, the federal court stated that basically what it said is the legislature's got to do something here, but we're not going to do something right away. At that time, the federal courts didn't believe it was appropriate to intervene. But you can see in this this excerpt here, there's a fairly deliberate statement that the pressure was on the legislature beginning in 1959 to perform its constitutional duty to redistrict. So there was a slightly complicated process there. The 1959 legislature did adopt a new plan. And as the slide puts it, it was perhaps a little more loosely based on population data than today's plans would be. And a new congressional plan emerged several years later, and this was all in the context of divided government. And you can see here, again, I'll breeze through these. They are in the packets, but if you'd like to take a look at the maps, things are beginning to shift a little bit there. It's a little less uniformly divided, geographically speaking. Then, in 1964, there was a federal court challenge to the way these plans were drawn. The backdrop here is that at the U.S. Supreme Court had decided several landmark cases in the early 60s, Baker v. Carr being the most noteworthy, and that moved. It was a tremendous disruption, I think, throughout the country, at least in the way redistricting had taken place. The one-person, one-vote principle was applied throughout the country, and the notion of an ideal population emerged there. You can see here, based on 1960 data, it would be 25,000, roughly, inhabitants per house district. And you can see the two numbers for 1960 here point out there was still considerable disparity in the way the legislative plan had been drawn, the smallest district being about 8,000 inhabitants and the largest 56,000. So, the 1959 plan was declared unconstitutional by federal court, a federal district court, and that court deferred and basically told the legislature, try again. I'm not going to go too far into what the court said here again. In the interest of time, I just want to highlight some of these statements here for you. You can see one person, one vote is placed here fairly explicitly. And the pressure is on, the court placed the pressure on the legislature in that 1965 session to do something. And what happened in 1965 was that the legislative plan for legislative districts was passed by a conservative Republican legislature and then vetoed by the DFL governor. The challenge to the veto that time failed, and there was a special session in 1966. A couple go-rounds here, and you can see plan number two was approved by Governor Rolvag in 1966. It's sort of fascinating to think in this context that in 1966 they were dealing with population data from 1960. So the process kind of lagged the development of the data a little bit there. In the 1970s, Minnesota's population continued to increase, up about 12% from 1960. And a congressional plan emerged and was enacted and approved in 1971, again in the context of divided government. And the map is included here again for your interest. In 1971, the House approved a legislative plan and the Senate did not concur. And an extra session in 1971 resulted in a plan that was then ultimately subjected to a pocket veto by Governor Wendy Anderson in late 1971. And at this point, the federal courts intervene and declares the existing set of districts, the 1965 plan districts, I think, invalid. because they're based on that 1960 data. And here's where you begin to see criteria, additional criteria emerging. There had been some discussion previously, but this is fairly specific. The federal court directed that all districts, including House districts, which are, I should have pointed this out earlier in the state constitution, those were not and are not prohibited by the state constitution, a multi-member House district. But the court was explicit here that the House districts needed to be single-member districts, compact, contiguous, with an equal population goal. And the court set a plus or minus 2% allowance for those districts based on, and allowed that for the purpose of preserving political subdivision boundaries. In other words, if it could be explained, if the deviation could be explained because the boundary lines needed to be followed, that would be acceptable. This set of criteria provided no allowance for consideration for incumbent residents or for political voting patterns, which might be described as political competitiveness. Then in late 1971, this is kind of amazing, the federal court decided that the legislature needed to be reapportioned in order to best accomplish redistricting, and decided to decrease the number of districts for both bodies, 35 Senate districts, 105 House districts. The Senate took an appeal to the United States Supreme Court, and, in 1972, I should say, I think the Senate prevailed there. The federal court issued a plan based on that reduction in size, but you'll see on the next slide that the Senate prevailed in April of 1972. The U.S. Supreme Court ordered the federal court to issue a new plan adhering more closely to the size of the legislature that was mandated in statute. So in June of 72, the current size of the legislature emerges in the federal court plan, 134 House districts, 67 Senate districts. And here you have the boundaries that were established in 1972 under the federal court plan. And there's additional detail provided here. As you can see, for quite a while, the urban districts didn't have as much detail because of the way population shifts had not been addressed. But now you're getting much smaller, more compact urban districts. In the 1980s, again, additional population increase. Minnesota retains its 8 congressional districts, 7% increase from the 1970 data. The process continues to get more complicated. The House in May of 91 introduced a plan, and then different plans were approved by the House and Senate, and the conference committee failed to reach an agreement in early 1982. That's for the congressional plan. The legislative plan had a slightly different result. The Senate introduced a plan that was approved rapidly. That died in House committee. So again, federal courts need to intervene because of the pressures that are now in place through a series of U.S. Supreme Court decisions. And the federal courts set legislative boundaries. The priorities are expressed here. The differences I would highlight, I think here, the fourth bullet point, you can see there's the increasing probability of minority representation where possible, and trying to include the metro area residents within districts that are located within the 7-county area. And there was an allowance made for constituency legislator relations, and that's another way of expressing, I think, continuity, the idea being that the residents of these districts have an interest in continuing to work with the members who have represented them in the past. That's and constituency legislator relations is another way of describing that. So in 1983, the legislature took the court-ordered plan and basically adopted it with some minor adjustments. And you can see the districts as they were set in 1982 here. The congressional plan took a different route. The courts declared that the plan based on the 1970s data invalid in late 1981. This gives you, just kind of putting it in context for the present day, you can see the amount of time the courts are willing to allow the legislature to try to deal with this before they step in and declare the old districts from the previous decade invalid. Four plans were submitted to the federal court, and you can begin to see a variety of players emerging here. The plaintiffs, the state Senate, and then the independent Republican congressional delegation submitted two different plans. There was a revision of the plan the House had passed and a totally alternate plan. The federal court decided to draw its own plan. And it based that on the this is for the congressional plan. Again, there are slightly different standards applied here than were for the legislative plan. There was a recognition of the divide or the that basically half the people in Minnesota live in the metropolitan area and half live in the outstate area. So there was consideration given to that in drawing the districts. And again, additional recognition, thankfully, of the Constitution's requirement of convenient contiguous territory. And there was an interest in using similar principles that had been used for the legislative plan. And then there's a reference to some other adopted criteria. I won't go too far into these. Once we start talking about the individual decisions, it's pretty easy to get into the weeds very quickly. So the congressional districts were subjected to a very tight maximum deviation of plus or minus 0.25% in the 1980s. Political subdivisions were preserving political subdivisions was a priority. And here it's stated a little more explicitly. There was a priority given to preserving the voting strength of minority populations and, wherever possible, increasing the probability of minority representation from areas of sizable concentrations of minority population. And much of these criteria are developed in response to U.S. Supreme Court decisions that were applicable to redistricting in Minnesota as well. And there was an allowance given to preserving communities of interest, which is a new term that surfaces here for the first time. And there'll be a little more about that later, but I think a good way to describe it would be geographic areas. For example, the Iron Range would be a community of interest. So here are the congressional district boundaries put into effect by the federal courts in 1982. Now getting to the increasingly more complex time period and more toward the present day. Again, the population in the 1990s grew sufficient to allow Minnesota to retain its 8th congressional district. The 1990s was, I think, could best be characterized as a more complex mix of legislation and litigation than any time previously. In the 91 regular session, the legislature adopted two concurrent resolutions that set standards for redistricting that were to apply to the 1990s process only. In other words, these weren't placed into statute, but were both bodies agreed that these principles would apply to plans that were adopted. There was a statutory deadline for enactment of the new plan. The legislature had kind of set parameters for itself. 25 weeks before the primary was the deadline recognized in law. The House and the Senate approved a legislative plan. That plan became law without the governor's signature, and I won't tell you the story about that one. I think people are familiar with what happened in the early 90s with Governor Carlson. The Senate minority leader challenged that plan based on technical errors in the plan and basically said those errors had led to kind of fundamental violations of some of these important principles, that they caused it to be there were problems with compactness. It was non-contiguous and not equal in population. So this challenge was consolidated with a previously filed suit in federal court. The federal courts took jurisdiction.
Oh, and Mr. Bodern, give you a chance to take a breath. So strange little fact that I will confess to is that you've kind of very diplomatically gone over the history of the 1991...
debacle, we called it.
Yeah, Senator Rest has used the word debacle. Governor Arne Carlson at the time had some really good staff working for him. I was one of them. And I vividly recall some of the details surrounding the circumstances, but I think it's safe to say the governor wanted to veto this redistricting plan that was on his desk, and along with I think a dozen other bills. Those bills were not properly vetoed in a timely fashion, and that went on its own route of litigation. So Yeah, I think it's I won't editorialize anymore, but I can say I was there. And it actually provided some job opportunities for me because some staff was moved after that.
I was there, too. Anybody else?
Yeah.
1991.
We'll hear Senator Rust's memory of it, too.
Yeah. It was very vivid.
Proceed, Mr. Bonner.
So, Mr. Chairman, the interesting thing there is the plan was enacted without a signature, but that certainly wasn't the end of the story. A state court panel then intervened and declared the legislative plan unconstitutional. And bear in mind, the backdrop here is there's also federal litigation at the same time. And the state court panel put together a plan to draw its own plan, announced the procedures for drawing its own plan, and placed pressure on the legislature to enact a new law. Then the exciting development here is that in late December of 91, the federal courts issued an injunction preventing the state court from taking any further action. So you had very significant federal-state tension here. The state court continued, issued its own revised, corrected legislative plan, which was still subject to a federal injunction. In early 1992, a special legislative session was convened, and the legislature approved a plan for the congressional districts and a plan that corrected the prior legislative plan that had some errors in it. In early 19...
Senator Rust.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bodden, I noticed at the end of your report that we have the legislature is to propose a plan. It has to be done by February 12th of next year. It, in terms of the primary date, the 25 weeks requirement, in 92, when what would that date have been? When did it have to be done? By in April, was it?
You are testing me there, Senator Rust, Mr. Chair. That sounds about right. I think that's about the shift in time, the difference that you're referring to would correspond to that.
And on that
so
point,
these dates are not as scary because of when the primary was as they would be today is what I'm trying to point out.
And you and I had a brief discussion of this, Senator Rust, but you might want to lay that out a little more about how, because we have moved our election calendar,
right?
It will
to the second to the primaries, the second general primaries, the second Tuesday in August. It means that a plan, if it's to be done by the legislature, has to be finished and approved by the governor, if we go that route, by February 12th. And generally in the even year, we don't come into session, right in January. So, Mr. Chairman, Senator Koch, you might want to be thinking about that with your counterparts if we do not get something done this session about that timing, if the legislature is indeed to be a player. And just something.
Good to note. Mr. Bonner.
So, Mr. Chairman, then in early 1992, the U.S. Supreme Court ordered the injunction against the state court lifted. That's a very significant case going forward, again, throughout the country in determining which courts have primary jurisdiction over redistricting. And that case stated a very decided preference for the primacy of state court jurisdiction. Both of the plans the legislature approved in early 1992 were then vetoed by Governor Carlson. The state court legislative plan went into effect for the 1992 elections. But again, and I think I kind of jumped the gun a little bit here. The timetable you see on this slide is a little more precise. The federal court issued its own set of plans and stated that those plans preempted the state court plan. And in March of 92 was the full appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, where it upheld the state court plan for legislative boundaries and the federal court plan for congressional boundaries, and stated there should be additional hearings on challenges to those plans after the 1992 elections were concluded, I think just to allow things to proceed in an orderly manner for those elections.
Senator Rust.
Yeah, just a little addition to that February 12th date. It's not so much. It's not only about being a player. It is, regardless of whether we're a player or not, wherever you live on February 12th of 2012, and you want to run for the legislature, that's the district you run from. Whether, regardless of where the lines get drawn after that. So that's another consideration in terms of the legislature being a player with regard to pairings, and which are invariably happen. But it's where you live on February 12th that will determine what district you either run from or decide not to run.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rest, that's correct. That's the six-month residency requirement applied to the current timeline for primary and elections. So you can see here that the February 93 U.S. Supreme Court decision is the one I described previously, and that's basically a statement that the federal court should have deferred to the legislative and state court processes more than it did. In 1994, the legislature took up the court-ordered legislative plan, made some corrections, and then took the court-ordered congressional plan and enacted those into law. And there were subsequent modifications made as late as 1997, I think probably also due to more technical considerations about the way those plans had been drawn. The end result of that 1990s process, and this is sort of recapping what I described a little bit earlier, there were elections held during the 1990s under different plans. The 92 elections were legislative boundaries as they were ordered by a state court panel, with congressional boundaries as ordered by the federal court panel. In 94, legislative boundaries were basically the same. There were some technical corrections, but the congressional boundaries reverted to the order of the three-judge state court panel. So you can see how complicated that became. Moving ahead to the 2000s, the last time we went through redistricting, again, a similar population gain. Minnesota's close to 5 million at that time, and again, keep retaining 8 congressional districts. What you see here, and it's similar to what's happening at the present time, the parties who know they're going to be involved basically tell the courts, please prepare yourself. We would like you to be available. So on January 4th, plaintiffs filed suit in the state court alleging those districts were unconstitutional if they were to remain in effect for the 2002 elections based on the earlier census results. And if I didn't state that quite clearly enough. What they were alleging was that if the elections were to be held in 2002 using the districts that have been drawn in the 90s, that would be unconstitutional because of the new population data. And then subsequent to that, the plaintiffs in the 1990s actually asked the three-judge panel, the state three-judge panel, to reopen that litigation and declare those districts unconstitutional. This was directed to the Minnesota Supreme Court to try to sort all of this out. And what you see here in March of 2001 was this the effort by the court to basically set up a system that would be in place in the event that a legislative plan failed to emerge. As you can see, the motion was stayed pending the need to create those new districts. A 5-judge panel was appointed in July of 2001, and you can see that the quote here from Zachman v. Kiffmeyer makes it clear that the court wants to defer to the legislature. So the pressure was on. And in October of 2001, there are some additional parties added permission to intervene. The 5-judge panel in December of 2001 established some criteria. These are fairly similar to what you've seen before. You can see a couple of new items. The compactness is used to determine the fairness of boundaries. I think that's a slightly different application there. And the court stated explicitly that no substantial weight would be given to the impact on incumbents or parties, what you can think of as kind of the continuity requirement, stated another way. And then the For the first time here, the five-judge panel sets a schedule for statewide public hearings. It's kind of expanding the scope of the process it's going to use in determining this case. And in March of 2002, in the absence of a legislative plan, the five-judge panel issued a new set of legislative and congressional plans.
And so, Mr. Bodern, are you saying between January of 2002 and March of 2002, there were statewide public hearings that were conducted by the judiciary?
Mr. Chairman,
I see that there was a schedule. I'm not recalling it. And
Mr. Mansky here is helping me out and telling me that there were six statewide hearings held.
Okay.
Thank you very much. So,
thank you.
Those boundaries were set. You can see in the legislative plan, the deviations were quite small. And the interesting summary here is the number of political subdivisions that were divided in that plan. Again, that was a priority in establishing that plan to avoid dividing them. 31 counties were divided, 25 minor civil divisions. That would be cities and towns, I assume. And the House had a correspondingly larger number. Communities of interest were preserved, specifically some of the tribal reservations, and then these other, I referred to the Iron Range as an example. You can see some others, the Red River Valley, the St. Croix River Valley. Communities with shared services, one example that would presumably be the metropolitan area. And the neighborhoods in Minneapolis and St. Paul were recognized more explicitly than they were before. There's some interesting language in the court opinion basically recognizing them as very distinct communities of interest. And minority groups were also reflected in the preservation of those boundaries. And as I said before, political competitiveness was not made a factor. There was some treatment given to incumbent protection and conflicts between incumbents. So here's the 2002 plan. It's kind of fun when you look through the different plans to see how the quality of the mapping is improving here. All of the old ones look sort of nice in their own way. The litigation that resulted from the congressional plan required zero population deviation, a very strict standard between the congressional districts. So these are the factors that were used here. You can see it was determined based on a population shift analysis to give the urban and suburban areas of the state five districts, Greater Minnesota three, and new communities of interest were defined for the purpose of the congressional plans, the I-90 corridor and the I-94 St. Cloud corridor, and the suburbs were given distinct recognition by the court. There's the map again. All these are in your packets, and I think they're reasonably easy to look at, perhaps not as detailed as you might like, but it does tell a story. The analysis here of how the litigation unfolded, I think, is also very informative. It took about 21 months from when the suits were first filed until the court issued its plan, until things were concluded. The grouping of interested parties, or the groups of interested parties, also became a little more complex. You can see there was basically a Republican and a DFL set of plaintiffs. The governor was a party, and then a collection of DFL legislators and members of Congress. Amicus briefing was involved. The last bullet point here, I think, is also significant. The plaintiffs collected attorney's fees because the court issued the plan, and the legislature failed to do its work. So that totaled about $368,000. So that is another consideration in developing a plan. There's perhaps some cost savings involved there.
Mr. Bodern, if I can kind of put you in a timeout here, I want to I think this might be the moment when we have most of our members here, and I want to honor Senator Rest has an 11:30 commitment. So just wanted to members have a brief introduction of the members and staff as we start down this road. And I want to start with welcoming again Senator Rest, who is the lead for her caucus on this issue. And Senator Rest, I look forward to working with you on this. So maybe we'll put you on the spot, Senator Ross, but let's we'll go around this table, and there's also some folks on either side of me that we should introduce, and just so people can put a face to the name and understand what people's responsibilities are. So, Senator Ross, if you want to just give a little bit of your background, I think
sure.
Almost everybody here knows you pretty well, but you have the distinct characteristic of having some very specific redistricting experience. You've seen some of this. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have served on redistricting subcommittees or committees, both in the House when I served there and in the Senate. I have a lot of interest in detail in terms of how it affects public policy and how we and governance, and so redistricting is something that is very appealing to me, quite frankly. My district currently, I live in New Hope, so it's a suburban area, and I know that there's a lot of growth in the suburban areas in Minnesota and in the metropolitan area, and I'm sure we're going to see some very interesting suggestions for how those districts will look in the coming decade. I've also supported, by the way, changing the size of the legislature, making it smaller. I supported Senator Olson's plan in the past. Probably that's not going to happen, but I still think we need to keep in mind when we look at your list and see that there's one Senate district right now. I think, Senator Sinchem, you have that list there on the front. One of them is like 9,000 square miles. If we did lower the number of districts, would that mean that we'd have a senator that had a district that was 12,000 square miles? So there is some...
Sounds like a state.
It's a real conundrum, I think, with regard to that kind of change in the size of the legislature. Mine is only 21 square miles. Right now, I can get from one end of it to the other in 10 minutes without speeding. So I'm pleased to be here and look forward to working with all of you.
From one end of my town to the other.
Senator Gerlach.
Large district, 57 square miles. So it's a little larger, but still the same problem as some of the rural districts. I don't have a lot of experience with this, with redistricting. In fact, the last time I went through this, I was elected to the House in 98, and so I had one term in the 90s, or that plan from the 1990s, and then immediately went was given a district. I didn't participate in the process as a freshman legislator, but was given a new district. So this is fascinating for me to learn all of these different criteria and the complexities of it. I think one of the biggest differences that's going to be probably facing us this time, as opposed to previous times, is that everybody can pretty much draw a map now, probably from software on their phones. Mm-hmm. And there'll be no shortage of, I think, people contributing ideas and mm-hmm. suggestions to the work we're doing, whereas I think in previous decades it was probably somewhat limited to just the people who sort of had the ability to do that. So it's going to be a different dynamic for us, I think, mm-hmm. this go-around. I don't have a whole lot of other things to philosophize about. But
Thank you, Senator Gerlach. And I know on certain issues you share Senator Rest's love of detail. I think that'll be very helpful to this committee. Very helpful. Senator Sinchem, good morning.
Good morning. Dave Sinchem, Rochester. Obviously none of us have a lot of experience, although locally I guess we could claim some experience.
You were on the city council during
going back to 2000, the early 2000s, and as we thought about our city down there, actually we convened a group with a county board and started thinking about Rochester. Prior to 2002, Rochester had basically been one Senate district. City of Rochester was one Senate district. Maybe there was a little spill out here and there, but Senator Cascaden was the senator. And so as that group met locally and thought about, you know, the future of our community, it was determined that we ought to be recommending to the court, which we did, that the time had come when our community had, or at least should have, representative by two senators. And, of course, that then involved having a senator that not only represented part of Rochester, but a rural area as well. And so at the time, I had no idea that I was going to be one of those, but as it turned out, that's the way life works. But so, yeah, we went through, you know, little local mapping and things like that with the planning department, looking for, if you will, communities of interest and cohesiveness and that kind of thing. I suspect to some degree I bring some knowledge of at least southeastern Minnesota in terms of, you know, how that might be configured from a standpoint of communities of interest.
Senator Sinjum, just a curiosity, was Rochester, did you have wards on city council, or were you elected citywide?
No, we had six wards.
Six wards.
And of course, a mayor and a president of the council was elected citywide.
Great.
But, my council district, their ward, was in part most of the House district, as it turned out to be.
Good to have you on the committee, Senator Sinjum.
Good.
Good morning, Senator Harrington. Look forward to serving with you.
Good morning. I'm glad to be here. In terms of experience with redistricting, I have none. So I have some experience with maps, but mostly crime maps.
Yeah.
And precinct designs in terms of trying to figure out how you spread crime out over the course of a city and not so much worrying about how many people were in any of those particular boxes. But given that, I do have an interest in the detail. I've spent a lot of time looking at that kind of mapping. Mapping software is something that I'm very familiar with from the police department, from planning activities in that regard. I'm also really interested in one particular facet of this is the whole issue around prison gerrymandering and how the number of people that are in prisons affects how we distribute population also. So that's an area that I'm particularly interested in, and also interested in the communities of color and how this redistricting will affect representation as the first black senator in 30 years. Would obviously like to see us create maps where that's more likely to be more people of color coming into elected office also. So that's another area that I am particularly interested in here.
Great. Thank you. Senator Nino.
Well, I've not been involved in the redistricting process directly, although I've been paying attention since about 1990. I remember that debacle back then, watched it, and just stood on the sidelines shaking my head. I represent a northern exurban district, about 800 square miles. I was just commenting, I don't think I can get from one end of my town to the other in 10 minutes, where I live in Cambridge, too many stoplights. But a very fast-growing exurban area. At one point, I live in Isanti County. At one point, that was, I think it was in the top 10 counties in the country percentage-wise for growth. And geographically, that area, if the Senate district boundaries stay similar to what they are now, geographically would shrink significantly, not quite so much as my esteemed colleague over here, a little more northwestern area. But have been involved politically since late 80s, early 90s in my second non-consecutive term here in the Senate, and was pleased to be able to get an opportunity to be involved in this level of planning. And I do hope that the legislature can come to an agreement on a plan that the House and the Senate and the governor will all agree to. I think that's the best end for everybody. And hadn't even taken into consideration the fiscal costs. So maybe if we pass something this year, we could get a positive fiscal note. Maybe solve the budget. I don't know. Let's see.
I like that thinking, Senator Nino. Senator Bach is also a member of this committee, and he's not with us this morning. But I was, very eager to have both of our leaders from the state Senate be a part of this going forward. I think it's important. So look forward to Senator Bach's perspective. Senator Koch.
Wow. Yes, so Senator Amy Koch, District 19, and when it comes to population, I've got it. I've got the second largest Senate district by population on this. Only Senator Roebling beats me, I see. And then from the congressional side, I'm in the 6th congressional district, which is the largest congressional district, fastest growing. So it's going to be very interesting to see how all of that plays out. I'm looking forward to working with everyone. Like Senator Nenow, I would, I'd like to see a plan. I think from a time perspective, from a budget perspective, it'd be really something to get a plan that could be passed and signed by the governor. So I think that's a laudable goal.
I'll just real briefly introduce myself and then want to talk, have the staff introduce themselves. But I'm Senator Jeff Michelle. My district is the western suburbs, so the 3rd congressional district, Edina, and the western portion of Bloomington. I've been in the Senate for
number.
It's Senate District 41, Senator Senjum. I think we're about even, maybe down a little bit in that population chart you have. So I'm beginning my 3rd term here in the Senate. I do not have specific redistricting experience other than serving on the governor's staff back in 1991. Redistricting was not my assignment. I will again claim it was not my fault, Senator Nenow, but certainly was aware of what was going on. Myself, a few other members, staff, and others attended a redistricting conference last month in Washington, D.C., that was put on by the National Conference of State Legislators. So starting to get up to speed, and took the assignment from Senator Koch with some excitement. It's a very different assignment that we have. Once every 10 years, and we basically have to do two things, two plans, and you're going to say three because of the Met Council, right? See, and that's why it's so good to have Senator Rest here. She will not let me make any errors, and I appreciate that. So, Senator Rest.
Not that I don't intend for you to make.
Well done. So I really pledge to work hard with all of you. This is going to be a fun assignment for all of us. I recognize and appreciate Senator Mr. Bodern's already going through the history of this. This has been full employment for the legal profession, and I don't celebrate that. I don't celebrate that. We should be able to do our work here. We are the branch that was built for public input, public testimony, public hearings, accountable to the voters very directly. So I think the better work we can do here, the less work that lawyers or the judicial branch will have to do, and that has to be our goal. So quickly, to my right, Mr. Axvig, do you want to?
Yes, Mr. Chair. My name is Adam Axvig. I'll be serving as the committee administrator for the redistricting committee. I have a similar amount of experience, but I think the last go around, I was still trying to find a date to the prom. So it's been
nice.
Looking forward to working with everybody and outside groups and going forward with this process. So thank you.
And my all-star legislative assistant is helping at this committee table as well.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Emily Pugh, and I will be the committee legislative assistant for redistricting subcommittee, and looking forward to it. Not a whole lot of experience with redistricting either. Probably in the same position as Adam. Maybe not looking for a prom date then, but a little younger, but looking forward to it.
And Ms. Pugh is going to law school, and that might come in handy. Mr. Bodern, I don't know if we went through any kind of formal introduction with you. Anything that you'd want to add before we go have you jump back into your PowerPoint?
Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to do that. This, too, is also my first go-around staffing the redistricting subcommittee. I do have previous experience staffing the elections component of the when it was part of the state government committee, and developed some experience there that I think will be helpful here. Did want to point out to the members there's really a wealth of resources here through NCSL, through the LCC, the GIS office there in particular, And one of the functions I can play is kind of helping sort through that and finding things for you. I'm getting acquainted myself and trying to learn rapidly here, but there really is a lot of support available there.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Bonner. And hang on, let me just ask. So over here in what we call the bullpen, most typically is research or even some partisan staff, but if you guys were just, it would be hard to capture it on the tape, but if you could just stand and say your name and your kind of who you're working for and your responsibilities, that'd be great, just if we're going to be working more with you down the road. So,
Mike Tadada, majority research, experience similar to Mr. Axe Figs, except I successfully found a date to the prom.
Nice.
Look forward to working with all of you and learning more about the process.
Thank you, Mike. Vic?
I'm Vic Thorstenson. I'm the redistricting staff for the Senate PFL, and I was a chaperone at Adams.
and Vic, I think you're going to be humble about this, but I think you've been through this a few times.
Yes, I have. And for what experience is worth.
I think it'll be helpful. Thanks. You. Yes, sir.
My name is James Chang. I'm Senator Harrington's staff. I just want to come down. I have about the same amount of experience.
Great.
But I think, like a lot of the other staffers and members at the city hall, we'll be tracking. I just want to.
You're always welcome. You're always welcome. And then Barb, you wanted to say hello?
Hello. I'm Barb Suzanne. I'm page for Rules Committee and the Subcommittee for Redistricting.
Okay, great. Mr. Bodern, we're back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I see the time is passing fairly quickly here, so I can tailor this to whatever amount of time you want me to fit it into. I think we're just about done with a review of how the process has played out in the past, and we can look at some of the important dates in the process soon. There is discussion here of how the legislative process unfolded in the 2000s. Even though it didn't produce a plan, it's instructive in thinking about how that would occur or could occur this time. The House and the Senate met separately, developed different plans, and did not come to an agreement on a concurrent resolution that would establish common principles for redistricting. Senate File 1326, the conference committee was appointed for those principles, didn't agree, and discharged for the interim. You can see there's a comparison here. I think I'm going to move fairly quickly through this, just given that it's kind of late. But it's interesting to see where priorities were comparing the House and the Senate at that time in terms of principles that should govern the process. And the last go-round with respect to congressional redistricting plans, it's interesting to see that there were 11 different there were 10 different congressional redistricting plans submitted and 11 different legislative redistricting plans. Senate File 2377 was the vehicle and died in conference committee. In 2003 and 2004, the legislature did take up redistricting by making some boundary adjustments for four House districts. So there's, you know, a fairly clear pattern here that there's some correction required wherever the plans emerge from. For the present day, Minnesota's population is over 5,303,000, a small gain. And as everyone knows at this point, we did retain the 8th Congressional District. We learned that December 21st of last year. The congressional apportionment preserved that, but very narrowly. So here are some of the key dates on the timeline. The first really important date is when the final data is available from the Census Bureau to allow maps to be drawn using the official data. That date is somewhat fluid, and I think you'll hear some slightly different estimates, but basically it's going to be no later than April 1st, or should be. And you can see the reference to the February 21st deadline here for drawing new districts, and that's in law. That's got to be 25 weeks before the primary. Obviously, that was affected with the recent legislation that established the August primary. Of interest might be some of the subsequent local deadlines. There's a lot of work that needs to get done at that level after the congressional and legislative plans have been drawn. And you can see that the cities have 60 days after the legislative districts have been drawn to complete their work by April 3rd of 2012. And counties and some of the other local districts have a little bit longer, 80 days after the legislative districts have been drawn, and no later than May 1st, 2012. The state primary will be on August 14th of next year, and the general election will be on November 6th.
And Mr. Bodern, you've reminded me, I was actually at a, for staff and members, I was actually at a meeting this morning where I was told we may have an issue regarding what cities, a few specific cities, and if and when and how they redraw their wards, and they're concerned about having to do it twice in the course of the next year. I guess it includes St. Paul. I think Bloomington, St. Louis Park, and I don't know if there's someone here from the cities. I don't mean to get into this issue today, but just to alert staff and members, we may have something that we need to do more quickly than the plans that we'll be working on, and that may be something you've already heard about. I understand. I think there's a bill draft. I don't think anything's been dropped yet. I don't know if, Mr. Bodern, you've heard of that issue or if people have approached you yet, but Heads up.
Blue warned, Mr. Chairman.
And we've already had started to have a conversation in St. Paul, the discussion in terms of nominations for city council based on the ward system currently is already up in the air, because will you actually be living in the ward that you were running on at the time the maps come out becomes an issue. So as folks are already starting their political process for this year, they're concerned.
Yeah, and my understanding is we had a law change last year that might have inadvertently impacted what this group of cities needs to do or has to do. So a heads up on that. Mr. Bodern or Mr. Axvig, do you also want to quickly just describe the other materials that we have handed out? We did hand out you have a map with some colors, and just as I guess it's a bit of a foundation for what we ultimately will end up working on. And members have already made reference to this, but using 2009 population data, what our current Senate districts look like, square mileage, et cetera. But I don't know if, Mr. Bodern, do you want to describe those in any more detail?
Mr. Chairman, as you suggested, I think these are probably the items in the packet that are of most interest to members of the subcommittee. And from what I can tell, the members appear to understand them quite clearly. The color coding here, I think the type, I'm looking at the congressional district's handout, is very small and somewhat difficult to read, but you can see the green area has the largest increase in population from the ideal. Mm-hmm. And this shows you an ideal 2009 population for a congressional district based on that 2009 estimate of 662,000. So you can see already... I believe that's the, let's see, that looks like, I think that's the fourth district there that's, I think it's, looks like 12 to 14% above the ideal. And I don't know if I have a whole lot to add to that. The second sheet here is somewhat helpful, that it just shows you a little more clearly what the exact population numbers and area are. Is the legislative district, the Senate district handout, is also helpful because it does have the ideal number is 79,000, very close to 80,000, and a number of members have pointed out that deviation. These are based on estimates, and it's basically a sneak preview of what's coming.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Members, any questions regarding the handouts or the PowerPoint that Mr. Bodern went through? I wonder if...
While we have a minute,
Mr. Hubinger, can you join us at the table? And Lee as well. Again, I'll just serve this up as an introduction. But another one of the important resources, and another important place for the public. I don't know if Mr. Bodern, you want to hit the light so we're not blinding our guests. But another important interface with the public is the Legislative Coordinating Commission. So, Mr. Hubinger, if you just want to give a little intro and hello and explanation of where you fit into this process going forward, that'd be great. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm Greg Hubinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission, and with me is Lee Millier, the head of our GIS office. For those of you who are new, the LCC is a joint House-Senate commission that's made up of 12 members, six from the Senate and six from the House, and includes the leadership from both bodies. We provide support to the work of the House and the Senate. During the redistricting season, the LCC establishes a subcommittee on redistricting to help provide some guidance for the process, mostly on the technical side. That subcommittee met early last year, I think, and received recommendations from staff about the hardware and software that the legislature would use in developing their plans. That software and hardware has been purchased. The House and Senate and the LCC all have packages that are the same so that we can work together on this. The subcommittee, like all of the LCC functions, that subcommittee expired on January 1st, and the LCC would need to reestablish it. There are some other tasks that that subcommittee will need to take on as part of this, as part of the process going forward. The LCC's role in this during the process itself is to provide technical support, that one function that Lee does, to the caucus staff as they develop their proposals. In addition, once the caucuses have completed their plans, they're submitted to the GIS office where reports on that indicate how they comply with what the different standards are completed, and then when they're final, they're posted to the web so that the public can see them.
And Mr. Huberger, I don't know if you want to introduce Lee, or Lee, if you want to add to that, describe how you will be helpful. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Lee Meyer. I'm with the LCC. We actually post all the plans that are proposed during the redistricting process. I think Greg just mentioned the final plan. I'd be glad to answer any questions. I think you did a good job.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Botter.
Just two things I wanted to mention. I failed to give credit to the GIS office for these handouts, so we should make sure that members know that's where that came from. And I did want to repeat again, I'm thankful to and grateful for Matt Gehring's work preparing this presentation. Just wanted to make that clear.
Thank you, Mr. Botter, and thank you to the LCC. And maybe one of the things we will do going forward is make sure that people have names and phone numbers and emails, sort of committee members and staff, as we work with the LCC. One comment, going back to Senator Gerlach, I agree. I think the redistricting exercise of 2011 will be different because of the technology. I think we will enjoy more public input, very detailed. People will have the ability to, as you said, almost.
Maybe I just drew the maps on the phone, so we're really done for the year.
Maybe there's an app on Senator Gerlach's phone. It is amazing, and I think that'll make for a better outcome for all of us. Also, note maybe another piece of information we can give to members going forward is the House has a redistricting committee that is up and running. Representative Sarah Anderson is the chair of that. On the majority side, Mary Murphy is the lead on the minority side, and they've had a couple meetings already, and they are very eager to go out around the state. And today is their first meeting out of state in Greater Minnesota, and they've also expressed an interest to us, something for us to think about in having some joint hearings in other locations outside of St. Paul. So that's something we can think about. I would also like to work with schedules and LAs here to figure out what's the most convenient time for this committee to meet. At this point, we don't have a set time, but once that information, once we do get the census data in March, I think we will need to speed up and probably become more regular and formal in when and how we meet. So a couple things to think about going forward on the calendar. Anything else from members this morning?
Just a quick question, Mr.
Chair. Nino.
Is this on the GIS website?
Mr. Meyer?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, it is.
There you go, Senator Nino. A little weekend activity for you. All right. I appreciate everyone's participation on a Friday morning. Sir. Committee's adjourned.
Here, my kids can do it on.